The International Exhibition Part 2 was recorded at Documenta 10 and Sculpture Projects in Munster, 1997. The sounds being heard now are part of Philosophical Platform by Bert Thies. This installation, which formed part of Sculpture Projects in Munster, was sited on the lawn between the rear of the Schloss and the Botanical Gardens in Munster. But this double issue starts at Documenta 10 in Kassel with Marina Abramović talking about her recent work in the Venice Biennale, Balkan Baroque. Marina Abramović, we're at Documenta here in Kassel, but last week I was in Venice, and one of the enduring memories of Venice for me in 1997 was your performance, your work, and it would be useful for those listening for you to describe the elements of it.
You see, it's a long history about this piece, because since war in Yugoslavia, as I'm really Yugoslav, I had this need to react. But, you know, artist is not somebody who can react the same way like newspaper, you know, today. I had the need time to digest and to find out what response can be. And this piece for me, it's really not political statement, because I never make political piece. It's my emotional response of what happened in Yugoslavia. And to start with, as I can say, it's the idea of this is to investigate it where I come from. I come from Balkan. That's why it's called Balkan Baroque. And what means this Baroque thing? It's maybe people think on Baroque like, you know, aesthetical movement in art, architecture, and so on. But it's not this kind of thing. I reflect to the Baroqueness of Balkan mind. And to make more specific is that if you investigate the Balkan, is the really geographical position between East world and West world, between Eastern concept of time and Western concept of time. And as become a kind of bridge between these two walls. And as in the bridge, the winds always blow so strong, there is always turbulent situation there. Through the history, there is fights, there is conquering, one country to over another country. And as now, it's still kind of unsettled, tragic situations. And always Balkan people experience extremes in their emotions. Or there is extreme love on one side, or is extreme hate on another side. Or is it tenderness, or is it cruelty, or is the legend, or shame, or, you know, and so on and so on. Sex, very kind of strong element in this Balkan, you know, the culture and so on. So I was thinking how I can express all these feelings, and my response was to actually take the triangle of my own family, and through which one you can actually project whatever to happen in Yugoslavia, because my own family is present all these elements inside the molecular structure. So I took the mother, father, and me as a basic element of the story. 2 years ago, I went to Belgrade and interviewed the man who catched the rats as his own profession, the rat catcher. And he told me the story of the way how they catch rats in Balkan. And they become this wolf-rat story in the piece. And this story become the main metaphor about, what's going on. And then, in the same time, is interrupted by this double personality of the doctor telling the story about rats in almost scientific way, and then turning into this chardash madness does. Because it's about madness. It's about, you know, questions who doesn't have answers. Because even I don't know why all this happened, and nobody from outside the Balkan know either. Because there's so many opposite explanations. And then there is this father who is, you know, national hero from the war. He's in a general who is completely shamed what happened in this situation. And the mother who really doesn't want to see things and put his hands up or put his hands on the face. So that with the very kind of the minimal movements of the parents and the story of the rat and chardash, I like to actually make the drawing the story. And then in the space, I also have three objects. This tree, everything's to do with the tree there, you know. Three objects that are this vase made from copper. Copper is the transmitting energy element, and the water is a purification suggestion. So, and in a way, they reflect very much to this Orthodox background of Balkan, you know, the Russian Greek Orthodox. So that's another cross. And then I felt that this piece have to kind of stay there for 5 months. And the best way, I was thinking, by doing the performance of this cleaning the bones. And then I felt that the best thing will be to really kind of charge space with the energy. And then this was the idea of this cleaning the bones. But what happened emotionally with me, that most of the time when I step in the area of the performance, I can draw certain the distance, you know, emotional distance from the piece. But it's the first time in my life that I lost this control. From the beginning of this piece, the kind of impulsive crying, I could not stop because it was too close, the whole thing, to me. And the crying became the part of the piece itself, you know, the crying. And each time I would take one song, one verse of the song, different songs from my childhood, remember. And by repetition, actually, I would create a kind of pattern in which one I can, you know, do the washing, working, you know. And actually, after the performance, what will be left is the story of that performance that happened in the space, but without any kind of document or visual material, more than the installation it is, and just bones. So that's the reminders of the piece.
The experience of the performance was very memorable, in that one went down into a darkened space and you were sitting there with rotting bones and a big smell of rotting flesh. And the story of the rats was how rats can be trained to kill each other.
Yeah, you wanted to tell the story of the rat? I see, the story of the rat, Wolf, is that, as I said, this is the very old traditional method how you can catch the rats. And one thing you have to know about the rats, they have to eat double weight of the body. The teeth are growing all the time and they have to grind them on something, otherwise they can suffocate. They're very intelligent. If you leave the food with poison, they will not eat it, or they will send the weakest rats to eat, or the sick ones. And if they die, the healthy rats will not eat it. So, and so on and so on. So the Balkan method to kill rats is to fill the holes with the water and only take the same members from the same family, rats, male ones, because mostly genetically they don't kill each other, you see, in the normal situation. But then they put them in the cage, give them just the water, and when they give them just the water, even if they're not genetically killing same tribal members, just because of the fact that the teeth are growing and they're going to suffocate them, they're forced to kill the weak one and the weak and the weak and the weak, and then only one rat is left. And that rat, kind of superior rat, the strongest one in the cage, still get only water. And then rat catcher observe situation to the point when he see the teeth are growing and only half an hour is left for him to live. He open the cage, take the knife, and pull his eyes out of his head, and then left him free. So the rat is completely nervous, outraged, out of his mind, you know, facing his own death. He ran into rat holes of his own tribe and kill everybody on his way till a stronger, superior rat kill him. So, and the story finished, that's the way how we make a wolf rat in Balkan. And the metaphor can't be more clear. So, you know, that's the basic story of the team. And then, you know, the background of all this, that I was invited from the curator from the Montenegro section of Yugoslavian pavilion to present Yugoslavia. And during the period of time, 2 months, the curator was fired from the Minister of Culture. Minister of Culture took decision to not show my work there, telling that actually I can't present the true Yugoslav culture, and chose a naive painter, you know, who is now presenting Yugoslavia. And that was also painful. And finally, when Celan gave me the space, he gave me the space who nobody wanted in this pavilion, and it was dark. Annette Messager actually supposed to have the space, and she refused it because it was dark and ugly and very loaded with this heavy air conditioned system on the ceiling. And so, for me, it was just great. This was the space I needed, really, the cave, you know. And in the piece, smell is very important. You see, smell is something what we in art people don't use much, and the smell goes through every barrier. You know, you have the right emotional response to the people that goes straight deep. Even now, after all this performance, and I've been washing myself hundreds of times, I still haunt by this smell all the time. I have it in my nose; it doesn't leave me. You know, so it's quite strong.
So the whole thing really was a very vivid and powerful metaphor, which doesn't really need unpacking, because I think it's very clear but very vivid. And the fact that you used a space that was rejected, an unspace, and invested it with a sense of power because of what you're doing, I think is meaningful.
But you see, first of all, I come from this background of 70s performance, and it's very different attitude to performance with the young generation right now, because young generation, in a way, they make small interventions, then they make mostly video and make loop out of it, and the time they're doing it, it's a kind of manipulated time, but they don't go through the real experience in a way. And for me, it's very important, this real experience. So the period of 6 hours is a crucial, because 6 hours a day doing this kind of thing, you enter into the kind of space when you could not enter if you do it 10 minutes or half an hour. There's no way, you know. And with that kind of entering into that kind of space, you can also pull the public too inside that new dimension. And then with the public and me together, that piece really could work. And that's what really happens. So the period of time and the amount of work you put into it is very important. So this was actually 4 days, 6 hours.
One of the things I felt was that I was in the same space and the same time as you, rather in the same time, whereas there is a lot of performance where you feel you're watching a condensed version of an event, whereas there one felt one was living that event. But I'm reminded of the first performance I saw by you was actually here in Kassel.
You saw that piece?
Yeah. In 1977, where you were running against a barrier and you're actually physically injuring yourself, or at least bruising yourself. It wasn't artificial. It was in, an underground car park.
Yeah, it was really interesting when I came to Kassel this time, you know. It was now, these days, I really had reflection on that piece, and I said, God, this was my really beginning in that time. And we found the place, Ula and me, what was not official place from the Comenta. It was the subway garage from the supermarket. And we really wanted to place who doesn't have any kind of cultural background to the place, who's kind of virgin and free from this. And in that situation, what we done, they had columns, the space, and people could park the cars in the garage. So we asked the director of the supermarket to remove the cars. And we built two columns, who are exactly double weight of our columns existing. And we made this piece, very heavy piece, called Expansion in the Space. Because in these days, we was very interesting in relation to the body and architecture, and very minimal way, you know. So it was just ideas of pure bodies expanding in the space, and the pain was not the issue. The idea was really this expansion, you know, how do you push things out. And then in that time is the first time that I confront myself with a larger audience. Because before, the performance seat, 20, 30, 40, 50 people, that's it. But this was more than 1,000 people from the Castle, the Comenta, cultural public, but also the people who came to look for the cars from the supermarket, and the people walking the dogs pass by, something is happening. So it was this all the strange mixture of the audience, who really, I could use the energy of the audience and push my limits much farther than I could normally do. And I remember after that piece, I had to go 1 month somewhere, you know. We could not even lie in any kind of position of our body except on the back. Very, totally blue. The front was absolutely blue, you know. But I don't know. I never focused on the pain in that time. It was not about the pain. Here, in this piece, pain was extremely mental in nature, not physical, but mental. It was incredible pain. I really had this pain for the entire, you know, my country who went into pieces, who doesn't exist anymore. And that's the... So this is what happened. And it's strange that the crying became part of the piece, moaning became part. I didn't plan that, and I really didn't want it to. I was thinking, God, I should really have a control over this. It's not about pathetic things. But it was out of control, just came out as it was, you know. But real time and real elements in the, and they are very important to me. You know, they have to be real bones. They have to be real rotten meat. They have to be, you know, and then, you know, you have to, in the same time, kind of, you know, twist into the real strong message. But in a way, you know, I still present this kind of old values of the 70s. Honest performance work that all the friends of mine been doing in the 70s, and somehow I'm always kind of nostalgic that my generation stopped working on that, because I think there's so many things can be still done with the body, you know, And I think it's very important that how you maintain your body in real life and how you can really push your limits still and still search for the different moments in the performance, but it's not explored, all elements are not explored yet. But somehow my generation went into seclusion of their own studios. My generation went into seclusion of their own studio, kind of protected from the audience. But I always believe that the direct dialogue with audience, without object in between, is the most powerful.
And the body is the strategy.
Yeah.
And the psychology of the mind also.
Yeah, the body is such a still a huge book to research, you know.
So, what a surprise. Followed by Janicek. What about this Documenta 10?
I'm very depressed about it all. I think it's a terribly well-meaning exhibition, and many of its ambitions are ones that we should all salute. It's trying to be serious. It's trying to return some proper thinking to art. It's trying to mount a critique of what exhibitions are about. It's trying to do all these things, which are all worthy ambitions, but it's made itself astoundedly boring in the process, because it just seems to be so monopaced. It's as if it's the same artwork multiplied by 1,000 rather than lots of different things. And as an example of exhibition making, I think it's almost a tragedy, actually.
Do you think it's because it's really not an exhibition? It's a whole series of events and discussions and discourses over a period of time. So you can't get it by just doing it in the way we've always done Documenta.
Yes, I think it's a failure of exhibition making, the simple art of knowing that you need beginnings, middle, ends, highs and lows. The relentlessness of its atmospheres are due to the fact that it consists of however many it is, 121 person shows, rather than any attempt to give pleasure to an audience by sculpting the exhibition. I mean, you know, we're sitting now outside the main Frederick Island, the main gallery, and in the past, this wonderful open space in front of it has been used for things, not always good things. There was a Jeff Koons sculpture that people laughed at that grew in, covered in plants and grew into a dog. You know, Boyce used to put bits of rock out there. But it was used as a gesture of some kind of flamboyant exhibition making. And there's nothing like that here. And, you know, if I want to become a monk, I'll join a monastery. You know, I won't come to Documenta 10 for that. And this refusal almost to give anybody a glimmer of variety is, I think, rather distressing. And it's a shame because the ambitions are very noble, and indeed some of the work is very good. But it gets lost in this rather grey atmosphere. I mean, even the very fact there's so much black and white photography in it seems to create an impression of just greyness.
Was there anything, however, that you will go away with as a sort of an enduring image or an enduring reaction?
Oh, there's lots of things that I've quite enjoyed. There was a wonderful film about hijacking in the 60s and 70s by an artist who's born in Trinidad and I believe is now based in Paris, whose name, of course, temporarily escapes me. But that was a good example, I think, of trying to deal with serious subject matter. And the British do pretty well. I mean, I like the Richard Hamilton contribution. I thought Siobhan Hapaska was wonderful in this because she shows three sculptures, really, one of which is a large, rather amorphous, white, blobby bed with a white sort of sheepskin rug on it and an oxygen mask. And it's one of the few things here that has absolutely visceral impact. You know, you don't have to think about it. Nerve ends respond to this rather creepy whiteness of it. And that's what's missing in a lot of the show, is that sense of what Francis Bacon once said about art that circumnavigates the brain and appeals directly to the senses. You know, there's none of that here, or there's very little of it here. So when you come across it, I think you appreciate it. I enjoyed the Rosemary Trockel gimmick of the pig sitting in a concrete box, although it is a gimmick. It's not too many other things.
I mean, in many ways, the whole enterprise is an argument against itself, perhaps. So to make another documentary is going to be very difficult, very problematic next time.
The most tragic thing about this documentary is its sense somehow of being the last one. It is not going to draw big crowds. People will not come in enough numbers to this to make it financially attractive to do it again. I mean, it is. You know, the documentary is such a rare opportunity to do something big and important. You know, we've just come back from the Venice Biennale, but that takes place every 2 years. It's not as significant and as momentous an occasion. This is a momentous occasion. God knows how many millions of pounds it costs to put up. You don't take an event like that and treat it a piece of vanity exhibition making by just making a show that responds to some thoughts that you have as directly as this one does. You have to do more than that.
Noel Gooding, we're in this space at Documenta, which contains a work by Gerhard Richter called Atlas. Perhaps you could tell me what your impression is of this work.
Well, I think it's absolutely staggering. It's one of the most extraordinary, I think, art experiences for me that I can remember. It's called Atlas, 1962 to 1997, and it consists of hundreds of identically framed grids of photographs, snapshots, photographic material taken from the press, personal photographs, historical photographs and so on. What it constitutes is, in the first place, a sort of retrospective of Richter's concerns. 35 years of working as an artist. So it moves between the personal and the historic, between art concerns and family concerns. There are series and sequences of photographs of his wife and his child. And then on a wall facing it, there are photographs of taken from archives of the concentration camps and things like this. At various points, the aesthetic concerns surface, so the work based on colour spectrums and so on is represented by a whole series of cards, of documents, of raw materials for that series of works and so on. The drag paintings are also represented in a series of photographs of close-ups of the more recent paintings, of close-ups of the actual oil paint on canvas and so on. The whole thing is extraordinary. It is a map of his world and a map of all our worlds, really. The impact of moving from one thing to another, the way in which, although it's certainly not a kaleidoscope, because a kaleidoscope implies that you could reshuffle or shake and get a new configuration. It is very strictly configured, but one's movement around it, of course, isn't necessarily absolutely shaped. One can move freely, but in the first place, to move through it chronologically is to get this a linear and a progressive, if you like, picture, as I said, of Richter's consciousness during this period. But then to start moving around it in a more free way is suddenly to realise that there are all sorts of other relations, and that time is not fixed, and that what happens to us in the past is still with us, and what is happening to us in the present reflects back and reshapes our past. It becomes the occasion for a reflection upon the meaning of the photograph in our culture and the meaning of the photograph in this century. It's an extraordinary experience, and I think an amazing work.
One thing that has stunned me is the way in which photography has been critically central to both his life and his practice.
Well, yes, as I said, in a way that the whole thing moves between the artist as artist gathering material, using photographic material in various ways, as we know Richter has throughout his career, and reflecting upon photography as such, as part of his actual has been a large part of his concerns, as we know. But what it shows is that this art experience, if you like, this experience of Richter as artist, is something embedded in a life. And as I said, what's wonderful about this particular presentation is that it is, as it were, a demonstration of the actuality of the artist's life. And I can't think of anything that I've ever seen that actually does this, that the artwork demonstrates the life lived within the artist's practice, and the way in which the artist's practice goes back into and is part of his life.
So, Charles Escher, what have you seen so far in Documenta?
I've seen the Fredericianum, basically, which delayed me for so long because I thought it was really strong in many ways. I haven't seen the rest of the show, which is obviously the curator's fault.
But what have you seen in the Fredericianum that's impressed you?
Well, I think the Richter obviously stands out. I also really liked, apart from one, I really liked the Jeff Wall, the black and whites. They still had that sort of animation that he brings. I was looking at them and thinking about Craigie Horsfield in terms of the scale and size, and they're just of their time, of now, in a way that I think is really quite exceptional. And even in the language that he's using, with black and white, with these huge formats, actually they still really speak of an animated activity in each of the images, which is something that he can capture unlike anybody else. So I was really impressed by that. And then I saw a video by a young Belgian artist called Johan Klimoplay, I think, but that's probably the wrong pronunciation, which was basically a history of hijacking, or skyjacking as it was originally called. And it's an extraordinary film which sort of has a multiplicity of viewpoints, from Nixon and Lenin and Stalin through to the hijackers themselves, and actually gives voice to a strange sort of sympathy that you have with almost all the characters within that. It's a very formally structured film. Now, what was interesting for me is it really combined a critical edge and if you like, an engaged content with something which was formally quite striking, quite innovative. I mean, he could be a filmmaker or an artist, and it seems to be an interesting position that artists are increasingly occupying. And when they seem to be as adept at both skills in the way that he is, I think really we've got quite an exceptional person.
Last night you were talking about the way in which you've left Tramway, and I'm interested to know what your next project is.
What we're thinking of is I want to remain in Scotland, ideally. And we have to accept the situation in Scotland as a very marginal one, both geographically and not being a real country. So within that, I think what's important is not to stress the necessity of an institution, of a standing gallery, but rather to find ways of disseminating what's going on there within the international circuit. I think it's about, in a way, top slicing those people who are interested in art around the world, rather than trying to dig deep within the Scottish soil. So in order to do that, it becomes much less essential to have the whole infrastructure of a building and staff and opening times, and to concentrate on means of disseminating. And that will be working probably in the main with Scottish artists, but also with international artists, working on everything from an internet site to a monograph, and finding ways of producing and then distributing. And I think distribution is something that I'm not clear how to do yet, but I intend to find out, so that it successfully has a profile with people who are interested in what's going on, and they feel as though that, although it's not an artwork in its own right, is a means of understanding the situation and the particular skills of the people within that country.
I don't know what the reaction was, how the audience felt, what the clubs felt. The audience was almost irrelevant. The larger picture was very important, and that was just release. I've never given two shits about what the critics or the audience or the clubs thought about what I do. I'm surprised I can still get shows. I'm surprised I've been tolerated for 20 years. Underlying and accusing not only myself but everyone else of everything I can think of, which we're all guilty of.
So, why did you start making objects and images? And when did that start?
It's just another format. Photographs, sculptures, boxes, it's another format. Books, videos, films, spoken word performances, music. When I'm 60, I'll stick a paintbrush up my ass and go to town on some canvases. I'm not ready to start painting yet. It's whatever can express at that time what I see that I need to document. With the photographs, which run in three different kinds of series, one is portraits, the period between adolescence and adulthood, where people are they're children, really, and they're blossoming and they're blooming, yet they're bored as fuck and time moves too slow and they're just not ruined yet. I'm very attracted to, without exploiting. That's one element of my photographs, and I took a lot of those when I lived in New Orleans, of, you know, the adolescent natives and indigenous surroundings. I have a lot of photographs of statues, buildings, graves, since most of the buildings are, it's decay. I'm very fascinated. Just what all my feelings have been about.
Marjorie Althorpe-Guyton, have you got an impression of this documenta? And if so, what is it?
I think this documenta is about redundancy to some extent. There's so much work which is, well, websites, video, it's kind of work that needs a lot of time, and actually it's kind of work you don't need to come to documenta to see. After all, if you're accessing websites and dealing with that, you don't need to come to a specific place. It's, in a way, it's dealing with the end of this kind of event. Clearly, the 100 days, the 100 names is crucial and central, and I would say probably the primary force of this documenta. But then again, that's fragmented because it's not in blocks, so those individuals won't engage collectively, which seems to me to undermine, to some extent, the thrust of what Catherine David is trying to deal with. What she seems to be questioning is whether art's valency or power is sufficient to carry the freight of the kind of issues that she wants to address. And really, if you look at the work here, the powerful pieces are by some of the more senior artists. Hamilton, Pistoletto, Richter, which to me is a bit of a problem. The Hamilton installation is superb, and I would say probably the particle machine is a sort of a metaphor for some of the ideas which seem to be central to documenta, the notion of sort of bombardment of external influences. But science, in terms of ethical and political issues, is very skimpily addressed. This may come out in the 100 days. In fact, there's very little art here which is ostensibly to do with the body. Siobhan Hrabowska, for example, I think is quite interesting in terms of the fact not only is it very visceral and present.
It seems to me there's a sense in which Catherine David's argument is undermining the whole idea of an event of this sort, and it's almost impossible to get a sense of the argument because none of us are going to stay for 100 days, although people say, as you have, that it's going to be available on the internet. So what we're left with is only a fragment of this overall argument, but there's, at the same time, there's sort of a sense of lack of confidence in what we're left with here in terms of the presentations, the physical manifestations. I mean, the Friedrichsplatz in front of us here, the grass, there's nothing there. There's always been something, but that's always been used as a physical space.
Certainly, and the park outside the orangery is completely bereft. I mean, to come across the pigs, that's Trockle, isn't it? The pigs with all the litter of new piglets is a shock. And in a way, it's a bit of a spectacle, which in normal circumstances is absurd, you know. And one of the most absurd things I saw was a tour group being led by somebody like Roger Bevan from England with a flag. And what are they going to tour to? A few websites. You know, you don't need to come to documenta with a group of expensively dressed and rich people to go and look at a website. One of the works that is attracting a lot of attention, I think, because it is so visceral and so in your face, and yet it raises a lot of difficult issues, is the film on terrorism by Johannes, Belgian artist, which is very powerful because it is so spectacular. It's using the kind of footage which isn't allowed on television from a variety of archives. And a lot of people are drawn to that and seduced by it. But it is, in the end, highly exploitative, and it's a bit like trying to deal with Nazism or genocide. You're dealing with issues where you have to use a similar kind of language to the very thing you're trying to subvert, which is that knife edge it rides quite successfully. It's very clever. Certainly the music overlays and the script is very strong. So I'm yet to come to a conclusion about that, but I can see why people are so bowled over by it, because it rides above so much else here.
Since we've just been there, are there any comparisons with Venice that are useful to put into this frame?
I think there are. The fact that Hamilton's here and Pistoletto and one or two other senior artists is similar to Minimalia, which is the show that Bonito Oliver curated in Venice, which shows works of Italian artists in the 50s and 60s, which are incredibly prescient, very fresh still. The only thing here is that, yes, Hamilton, terribly important. His influence, though, isn't expressed in the sense that there were a younger generation of artists working in the 60s and 70s in Britain who are dealing with social political issues like Brisley, Steve Willetts, who would have a place here. What she seems to have done is not, I think, fully examine the historical context of the very things she's dealing with, and I think that would have made it even more didactic, but perhaps more meaningful.
Are there any other aspects that you think characterises this documenta?
The main thing, I think, is that it's transitional. What we're seeing is work which is very difficult to grasp in the kind of circumstances of a documenta, where you've got limited time, you know, you're on the hoof. From the outside, it's like looking through a glass window at a laboratory, but that's where we're at. It's almost sort of kind of late 20th century medieval alchemist's kitchen.
Thank you very much for this contribution. And I pass over to Katharine Davite, the artistic director of the Documenta 10. Thank you very much, and I would like to welcome you most cordially, even though we have an atmosphere almost like at Cannes. I would like to explain what is the sense and the purpose of the documenta at the end of the 20th century. A documenta where the great exhibitions have been called into question. It may seem paradoxical or deliberately outrageous to envision a critical confrontation with the present in the framework of an institution that over the past 20 years has become a mecca for tourism and cultural consumption. Yet the pressing issues of today make it equally presumptuous to abandon all ethical and political demands. In the age of globalization and of the sometimes violent social, economic and cultural transformations it entails, contemporary artistic practices condemned for their supposed meaningless or nullity, which is a quote of Jean Baudrillard, are in fact a vital source of imaginary and symbolic representations whose diversity cannot be reduced to the mere total economic domination of reality. The stakes here are no less political than aesthetic, at least if one can avoid reinforcing the mounting spectacularization and instrumentalization of contemporary art by the culture industry, where art is used for social regulation or deep control through the aestheticization of information or through forms of debate that paralyze any act of judgment in the immediacy of raw seduction or emotion, what might be called them, and in fact, overcoming the obstacle means a seeking out the current manifestations and underlying conditions of a critical art which does not fall into a pre-cut academic mold or let itself be summed up in a facile label. Such a project can ignore the upheavals that have occurred both in the documenta's institutional and geopolitical situation since the inaugural exhibition in 55 and in the recent development of aesthetic forms and practices, nor can it shirk the necessary ruptures and changes in the structure of the event itself. In many respects, the history and the political and cultural project of the documenta belong to the now vanished era of a post-war Europe, shaped by the Cold War and the world's division into two power blocks, and brought to a close by the fall of the Berlin Wall and the German reunification. The specific project of documenta also resulted from the progressive ideas of a local artist, Arnold Böder, and from the exemplary situation of Kassel, a city close to the eastern border and almost entirely reconstructed after the 43 bombing, 55 was a time for reconciliation, a need for expiation by means of modern art, which may explain the close association of the work and personality of Josef Beuys with the history of the exhibition from the third edition in 63 all the way to Beuys' death at the time of Documenta 8 in 87. Documenta also provided an occasion for the necessary reconstruction of the modern tradition and the history of the Vanguard's condemned by the Nazi regime for the exhibition of degenerator art. But this reconstruction remained incomplete. Skipping over Dada and the radical forms that emerged in the Weimar period to concentrate on the most recent development of abstraction, which had reached their apogee in America. Thus, the early versions of the document appeared as a cultural showcase for the Marshall Plan in the country that had become the privileged centerpiece of the newly forged alliance between Northern Europe and in the United States. In the 60s, Documenta became the largest international exhibition of contemporary art. Howard Seaman transformed the exhibition into a 100-day event attending to the aesthetic forms and attitudes of the period. But this striking synthesis of the major proposals of the 70s did not succeed in reversing the directions that Documenta had achieved.